A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on July 6, 2003, entitled, My Country, Right or Wrong? The text for the sermon is 1 Kings 22, verses 1 through 28. Copyright, Grand Valley State University. Please note that the original recording spanned two sides of a cassette tape, so there was some missing material.
The title of my Independence Day sermon is My Country, Right or Wrong? And I suppose there are some of you out there that may be thinking that I have turned into a chauvinist. Nicolas Chauvin was a French army officer in Napoleon's army, and in 1815 was fanatically, irrationally, unreasonably, belligerently hanging on to the ideal, to the idea of the empire when it was already a lost cause. And so chauvinism has become synonymous with a fanatical commitment to one's nation, patriotism, nationalism, belligerently expressed, hanging on to the honor and the glory of power. Well, that's not exactly what's happened to me, and I hope you will be glad about that. Although some of you might be comforted with that. My country, right or wrong? Forrest Church, in his book, The American Creed, tells about a time when, as a boy, he was rummaging around his grandparents' attic, and he found a wooden plaque which pictured a soldier, World War I soldier, with a wide-brimmed helmet. And on the helmet, in burnished brass, were the words, My Country, Right or Wrong? And Forrest Church must have done some research, because he found that phrase is lifted out of its context. Therefore, my title has My Country, Right or Wrong, ... And the three dots are what the sermon is about. It is a statement that was made by a Missouri senator in 1899 by name of Carl Schurz. And the full quote is, My country, right or wrong? If right, to be kept right. If wrong, to be set right. Now, you couldn't lift a phrase out of a quotation and make it say its opposite more aptly than that. On the helmet of the soldier, my country, right or wrong? But the full phrase indicated a kind of love and devotion for one's country that could never say, my country, right or wrong, period, but rather, my country, right or wrong, if right, to be affirmed, and if wrong, to be confronted. And that has been one of the great strengths of this great nation of ours. I am not going to read the reading from the present. It is printed It is a quotation from the book, The American Creed, and in which Forest Church sets forth that creed most concisely expressed in the preamble to the Declaration of Independence, but also indicates that in the light of that which has transpired since 9/11, we must not fear to be self-critical, to continue to test our nation's policies and direction in light of that American creed, which speaks of the freedom and the liberty and the justice for all people. And that has always been an endeavor filled with tension. And it is the responsibility of a free press and of the pulpit. For it is the free press and the pulpit that are to look critically at the directions of a nation and to call it constantly to its own founding principles and to those ideals that have made it great. It's always been a delicate and dangerous business. As Micaiah, the prophet of Israel, could tell you, I hope as I read that story that you smiled a little bit, because it really is quite humorous. The dilemma of that poor prophet. The situation is that the king of Israel, Ahab, notorious for his bad deeds,
summons King Jehoshaphat of the southern kingdom and says, "You know, Ramoth-Gilead over on the Transjordan is in the hands of Aram, and it really belongs to us."
And so Jehoshaphat, sort of in the position of a puppet king over against the greater power of the north, says, "Well, my people and my horses are as yours, but let's inquire of the Lord." And so Ahab, according to the custom in Israel, gathers 400 prophets. Well, these prophets obviously were on the state payroll. They sang with one accord a song of the imminent triumph of the king in his military exploit. Jehoshaphat from the southern kingdom could see that this was obviously a rigged situation. And so he said, "Isn't there anybody else?" "Well, yes, there's this guy Micaiah, but I hate him. He never speaks any good to me or about me." Nonetheless, Ahab calls Micaiah. Micaiah is warned by the officer that fetches him that all of the prophets have been of one accord, and certainly he should speak accordingly. And so he comes to the king, and Ahab raises the question, "Should we go to war?" And he says, "Oh yes, go up and triumph." And then the king looks at him and said, "How many times have I told you to tell me nothing but the truth of the word of God?" And Micaiah says, "Well, in that case, it'll be disaster." And Ahab looks at Jehoshaphat and said, "See, didn't I tell you?" So he says to the officer, "Take him back and throw him in prison and put him on reduced rations until I come in peace. And Micaiah says, if you come back in peace, then the Lord hasn't spoken by me. Well, I always get a kick out of this story, frankly, because it's the dilemma of the prophet. What's a poor prophet to do? Israel, you remember, was born as a confederacy of tribes that were very conscious of the fact that they were, in our terminology, a theocracy. God was king. And then there came a time when people said, we want to be like other nations. We want a king. You remember the great spiritual leader Samuel, who said, oh no, you don't want to do that. God is your king. Yes, we want a king. He said, you get a king and they'll tax you and raise armies, take your young people, etc. No, we want a king. So finally, relenting, Saul was anointed. But it was the religious leader, Samuel, in the name of God, who anointed the king. And the anointing of the king was the sign that the king reigned under the aegis of God. And with the rise of monarchy in Israel arose as well the office of the prophet. And so that Israel's history is really a history of the tension between the throne and the prophetic office. And the kings may have been almighty, but not in Israel. In all of the surrounding countries, that was the case. Eastern monarchs with total control, absolute power. But in Israel, the king trembled when the prophet spoke, for it was the prophet's role to speak truth to power. And a dangerous task it was, and a lonely task it was. I could have gone most anywhere in the Old Testament this morning. Jeremiah, for example, the time of crisis, after he's already been accused of being a traitor because he spoke about the imminent invasion of Babylon, the king seeks him out in secret and says to him, is there any word from the Lord? Jeremiah gives him the word from the Lord. Jeremiah ends up in the miry pit. Or Amos, who has the call of God to approach the royal house in Israel, only to have the royal priest come out and say to him, prophesy no more. This is the king's court. And it happens over and over and over again. That confrontation between the prophetic voice that calls the nation to its founding principles, to that Mosaic covenant, that concern for justice and for mercy, that concern for the marginalized and the voiceless and the poor, that concern for a society that was marked by equity and fairness, always against that ruling power that would run roughshod over the disadvantaged ones. Again and again, we have it in the Hebrew Scriptures, the prophetic voice raised against the nation, not because the prophet did not love the nation, but because the prophet loved the nation enough to call it to its highest and noblest best. And so it has always been. But the prophet is often an unwanted party. In our own generation, in our own lifetime, at least for some of us who are older, there was the rise of the Nazi regime, and one of the brilliant young students in Germany was Dietrich Bonhoeffer, of whom I've spoken here so often, who had the opportunity to come to this country on a study grant arranged for him by professors at Union Seminary in New York, who took the last ship that sailed for Europe, to the dismay of those who had arranged his visit. And all he could say to them was, "I cannot be here when my nation is in the crisis it is in. If I do not participate now in its turmoil, I'll not be able to participate in its future. I must return to my country to will the destruction of my nation in order that Western civilization may be preserved, lest my nation be successful and destroy Western civilization." And Bonhoeffer loved Germany. He was German to the core of his being. He loved his homeland. But eventually, being a pacifist at heart, nonetheless, saw the coming darkness and joined the conspiracy to assassinate Hitler, taking a desperate action against the leadership of his country in the name of that which was best and noblest of his nation, and in the name of that which is just and right. We, as a nation, are at a critical juncture as well. Some months ago, when I suggested the fact of American empire, I had many people say to me, "Well, we haven't heard anything about that, and yet now it's all over the place. It's a given. It's a cliche. The unipolar world. We, the one superpower in the world." And the question is, in what direction will we go as a nation? I would consider this message successful this morning if you would go out of here with an awareness and a thoughtfulness, and if you would grant me the fact that in raising the question of our present American situation and our future, that I am being faithful to the prophetic calling to which I am called. If you would go out of here thinking about the question, where do we want to go as a nation? I don't have time this morning to give you what is really a fascinating history of how out of that social gospel that I spoke of last week, there came this global vision. It was a global vision, really, for the evangelization of the world. But it saw the exporting of not only the gospel, but the American democratic ideal to the whole world. And it was really a spiritual imperative. So that vision has been around here for over 100 years of bringing to the globe, to the global community, the wonderful freedoms and the liberties and the way of life that we have found. But that global vision today has been taken over by a vision of empire whose imperative is not primarily spiritual, but really world domination, keeping, managing an unruly world. And this is advocated openly, and there is not lacking a measure of idealism in it. But the old internationalism, which was to be created through collective security and agreements and alliances, has now become an internationalism that will be enforced by militarism. And I think the question we have to ask is that which we have enjoyed as a nation, all of the blessings that have been ours, can they be force-fed on the world? And is that the direction in which we ought to be going in light of our founding vision, in light of those marvelous principles that form the American creed? Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in an address to Congress, spoke of the freedom from the four freedoms: the freedom of speech, the freedom to worship God according to one's own conscience, the freedom from want, and the freedom from fear. And the final draft of that address, he enunciated those four freedoms, and after each one said, everywhere in the world, everywhere in the world, everywhere in the world, everywhere in the world. He invited his staff to make comments. One of his principal advisors, Harry Hopkins, said to him, everywhere in the world, Mr. President, that covers a lot of territory. I'm not so sure the American people are really interested in Java. To which Roosevelt responded, Harry, it may be necessary for the people of America to be interested in Java. The world is getting so small. Java will be our neighbor. With a prescience that has become a reality, Roosevelt enunciated those four freedoms everywhere in the world. It is that kind of idealism that has marked us at our best. And it is necessary in this nation at this time to have a conversation in order that we might be aware, in order that we might have a determination about the future of this great land. My country, right or wrong, if it's right, affirm it. If it's wrong, set it right.